Hello, and welcome to today's Jewish Policy Center webinar. I am Shoshana Bryant, Senior Director of the JPC, and your host. Our guest today is Hussein Abdul Hussein of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Yes, he was here a few weeks ago, and he is back for two reasons. First, the last time we wandered off into unexpected places, but the feedback was really good from you guys, and you liked his responses, so I thought we'll have him back. But we are going to try to stick to today's subject, which is Lebanon. He is the best person I can think of to tell us what's happening, why, and whether perhaps Lebanon will be restored to what it once was, a lovely and prosperous country, and have a real non-terrorist government. And maybe it'll have peace with its neighbors. I don't know. He might, but he will speculate for us. Before we go to Hussein, your JPC commercial, the Jewish Policy Center was established in 1985. We are celebrating our 40th anniversary as a nonprofit organization providing analysis of foreign and domestic policies. We support a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, now more than ever, and missile defense. Most important today, we support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. And now more than ever, we support the efforts of the government of Israel and the IDF to defend the people of Israel on all of its borders and when necessary beyond those borders. We also support justice in Gaza, meaning all the hostages back, all of them living and no longer living. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC advocates domestically for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, energy security, free speech, and intellectual diversity. It is a big plate of subjects. You can find us on our website, jewishpolicycenter.org. That's jewishpolicycenter.org. You can read our inside articles, our quarterly magazine, In Focus, and you can find our previous webinar programs. They are good for binge watching with a glass of wine or a cup of coffee. And now our guest. Hussein Abdul Hussein is a research fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He focuses on the Gulf region and Yemen, and on Gulf relations and Gulf peace with Israel. And he was born in Lebanon. He was raised in Beirut, Baghdad, and Baalbek, cities that have been at the center of major Middle Eastern events. He earned a degree in history and archaeology at the American University of Beirut. He worked as a reporter and later as managing editor at Beirut's Daily Star newspaper. He reported from war zones on the Lebanese border with Israel and from Iraq. In Washington, Hussein helped to set up and manage the Arabic satellite network Al-Hura Iraq, after which he headed the Washington Bureau of the Kuwaiti daily Al-Rai'i. He's been a visiting fellow at London's Chatham House and published in English in the New York Times and the Washington Post. He is one of the few authors in those publications that you should actually read. He's been quoted everywhere. He's a frequent commentator, and he's written for In Focus Quarterly. His article, Why There Is No Palestinian State, is a must-read. So again, back to our website, jewishpolicycenter.org, In Focus under Publications, you will find him. And now, Hussein Abdul Hussein, I'm going to start you with a question, which I have received about 20 times from people as they signed in. Israelis and Americans have wanted to be optimistic about Lebanon since at least the Israeli-Lebanese agreement of 1983. The agreement didn't last long, and the subsequent hints of optimism never really materialized. Is there something different about today? Can we be optimistic? Where are we? Hussein?
Hi. Yes. Hi, Shoshana. Thanks for having me on. My answer to your first question is that I've been cautiously optimistic for a few months now. Of course, buoyed by the amazing victory of Israel in crushing Hezbollah. I don't think any one of us expected that to happen. I don't think Hezbollah expected that to happen. So this opened a window of opportunity. And of course, I say cautiously optimistic because even when we're optimistic, this is the Middle East and anything could go wrong any minute. So far so good. But we have to stay vigilant and we have to stay focused. What has happened since Israel killed Nasrallah and technically crushed Hezbollah, is that Lebanon came to the US begging. They said, please stop the war. And if you remember, when Nasrallah was still alive, he refused to stop the war without the war stopping in Gaza first. Now, after Nasrallah was killed, Birri, the other Shia leader who's allied with Hezbollah and Nasrallah, said, listen, we're untying our war from Gaza. We promise, we pledge to do whatever Israel wants. And of course, he knew that Israel wanted the disarmament of Hezbollah per UN SC Resolution 1701. And we're a game. So let us know what we should do to stop the war, and we'll be happy to do it. And Birri signed on the cessation of hostilities, which was signed on November 27, 2024. And more interestingly, the acting cabinet in charge at the time, was headed by a certain Mikati, who's a Hezbollah ally, and had ministers in the cabinet from Hezbollah who are Hezbollah members. So even Hezbollah signed on this cessation of hostilities. So what happened next was that Lebanon elected a president. It elected a new prime minister, appointed a new cabinet. The process started rolling. And now Hezbollah said, no, disarmament is not on the table. Israel has to stop policing us first and has to withdraw first from five remaining hilltops before we agree to discussing, even discussing, not disarming, discussing disarmament. So what you see happening is that Birri and Hezbollah are trying to move the goalposts to change the sequence of orders. And I think I wrote this week, and this is Beirut. I said this is the same model that Israel had to suffer from when dealing with Arafat. You agree on one thing, everyone is on the same page, and then as we go, they start changing the sequence of things. And this throws things off. So what you see now is that Hezbollah and Birri, what they call the Shia duo, the representatives of Shia in parliament, they're trying to change the sequence. What the government of Lebanon is saying, President Aoun and Prime Minister Salam and everybody else who's not the Shia representative in government and parliament, what they're trying to say is that, no, we signed on this, we committed to the United States and to Israel and the rest of the world that this is what we're gonna do. And if we do it, the world promised that we will be paid to reconstruct the area that was devastated by war, mainly in South Lebanon. So this is, we agreed on this, and we're going to pursue this. And of course, Hezbollah and Birri are trying to push back all the time. So what happened on August 5 and August 7, the cabinet of Lebanon held two meetings that proved to be really historic, in which the cabinet voted for the first time since 1969, since Lebanon conceded its sovereignty to PLO and the Palestinian factions to operate on Lebanese territory. Lebanon, for the first time, voted on a decision that stipulated that only the government can possess and use weapons on Lebanese territory. And this meant that from now on, the Hezbollah militia has become illegal. Now, of course, Hezbollah has been throwing so many tantrums, has been attacking the prime minister and the president. But it is fortunate that the cabinet has insisted on its position, and it tasked the Lebanese armed forces to come back to them with a plan on how to disarm Hezbollah before the end of this year. Now, today is Thursday. Tomorrow, Friday, the Lebanese cabinet is holding a meeting to listen to the Lebanese armed forces to check out the plan that the Lebanese armed forces has done and is now going to present to the cabinet. Now, there's a trick here, because the government set the deadline for disarming Hezbollah. What I hear from Beirut now is that the Lebanese armed forces are saying, we do not have the resources or the capabilities to do it in such a short time. So what the Lebanese armed forces are saying is that we need 15 months to get Hezbollah disarmed over all of Lebanese territory, whereas the deadline given to them, the end of this year, is only 4 months. So how do we reconcile these two realities, the deadline that the cabinet has given, and the real timeline that the Lebanese armed forces have given, this remains to be seen. Now, mind you, time is of essence because in May 2026, Lebanon goes to parliamentary election, and Hezbollah and Berri are really counting on this election, thinking that if they manage to re-win all the 27 seats in parliament, Lebanese parliament has 128 seats. If Hezbollah and Berri manage to keep the 27 seats, then the speaker will be one of them, and then we're back to where we are now, that there's little that can be done outside of making them or having them concede on a few issues. And number two, they're hoping that they will still get at least a majority or something close to a majority that can really obstruct whatever the new government will try to do in terms of disarmament and reconstruction and whatnot. So this is where we are now. I think that's why I said cautiously optimistic. We are standing in a good place, but nothing is over until everything is over.
Okay, so this does raise the next question about the Lebanese armed forces. We understand that they are also in the process of disarming Palestinian camps. You said something interesting that the Lebanese government gave Syrian and Palestinian forces the ability to operate freely inside of Lebanese territory. And I'm not sure how many people understand that the Palestinians have their own military in those camps. Is that a hot target for the Lebanese armed forces? Are they working on that? Or is that one of those theoretical things? Is the first half of the question. And the second half of the question is US aid to the Lebanese armed forces. We know they've been supporting them financially, and we know they used to support them physically on the ground. They used to train them, and they used to do. Are they still doing that? Where do we stand with the military?
So on the Palestinian arms and camps, in 1969, Egypt forced Lebanon to concede. 1967, the five or four Arab armies were defeated by Israel. And then Egypt decided to change the nature of the fight from symmetric war, army to army, to asymmetric, that is, militias against the Israeli army. And 1969 is when Lebanon was forced to concede that the Palestinian factions could operate from its territory to launch attacks across the southern border with Israel. Jordan was also another country that was supposed to allow the Palestinians to do the same thing, but Jordan turned out to be wise and it ejected the Palestinian factions, disarmed them, threw them out of the country. All of them moved to Lebanon, and their armed factions was the reason why the Lebanese Civil War started in 1975, because the Lebanese state said, listen, this is our state. You can't really drag us into war with Israel. The country split, and that's how the Civil War started. The Civil War started in 1982. Israel invaded Lebanon, ejected the Lebanese, ejected, I'm sorry, the Palestinian armed forces, including Arafat. Now, a few remnants of these forces remained. Lebanon used to have 12 Palestinian camps after 1950. I think now they're nine or eight. A few of them were destroyed. Tal el-Za'atar was swept by the Christian fighters in 1976, I think. You have Nahr el-Bared in the north was also wiped out a few years back during clashes with the Lebanese military. Long story short, what they have are nine camps. A few of these camps still have arms. Now, I wouldn't say that these arms threaten the sovereignty of the Lebanese state. This is nowhere near the arsenal that Hezbollah has. They don't have a chain of commands similar to the sophistication of Hezbollah's military operation. Another thing, the biggest of these camps, which is called Ain al-Hilwi, and it's next to the coastal city of Sidon in South Lebanon. Ain al-Hilwi is the biggest camp, and this is where most of these arms, what has remained of Palestinian arms, are kept. Ain al-Hilwi is surrounded. It's fenced in. It's not an open space, and the military surrounds it from all sides. So if you have to go in and get out, I've been to that camp dozens of times in my life. The military does check your trunk going into the camp if you're driving a car and if you're coming out. So at this point, I wouldn't say that the Palestinian arms are a threat to the Lebanese sovereignty. What you saw that Hamas threw rockets in this past war last year from Lebanon to Israel, all of this was mainly Hezbollah. Hezbollah would get like a couple of Palestinians, tell them, okay, you're Hamas. Say you're Hamas. Okay, now this rocket will be fired in your name on Israel. So technically speaking, the Palestinian military presence in Lebanon is not a threat to Lebanese sovereignty. If it ever becomes a threat, the Lebanese armed forces can deal with it swiftly and quickly. And there's consensus among the Lebanese that the Palestinians should not have arms in their country, given, the history of the civil war and the bad blood between the two sides. To the second part of your question, whether the Lebanese armed forces are capable or not. A few years back, we decided that we have to bankroll the Lebanese military. After 2019, the Lebanese economy collapsed, free fall, completely collapsed. The government stopped paying, or the government was actually paying salaries, but the salaries turned into, if you're a soldier, probably be paid the equivalent of $1 a month, which is not really money. So we stepped in the United States, and we decided to bankroll the military, which was a good move, thinking that without a military, we risk that the state will collapse, and then terrorism will spread, and then narcotics will be exported, and refugees will get on boats and go through the Mediterranean. So we decided to bankroll the Lebanese security and armed forces, and we were paying these guys $72 million every 6 months, so $144 million a year. Now, that's, mind you, that's not a big number in U.S. terms, but it's the annual budget of the Lebanese armed forces. And every now and then, because the Lebanese armed forces were not doing really what we wanted them to do in terms of going after Hezbollah, so there was pushback on the Hill, and this money was interrupted a few times. So as we speak right now, this $144 million is being paid by the state of Qatar, which is not to my liking, but this is the only available source of funding to these guys. So, and mind you, the 144 million, this barely pays for the salaries of these troops. There are some troops who are taking a second and a third job to make ends meet, which shouldn't be the case. And I mean, if people are in the military, they should be in the military, not in the military and working as valet parkings or nightclub bouncers. Another thing that I heard from people over there in Lebanon is that the military needs basic stuff. Forget the bullets and the arms and the arm systems. They need fuel for their vehicles. They need drinking water. When the military goes to the south, I mean, this basic logistics support they can't afford and they don't have. And at this point, I think they're still suffering from this issue, and this affects retention of force. So they've lost a lot of people. So now they don't even have the numbers. When this president, Aoun, who was the army chief, was elected president and he appointed Mr. Salam as his prime minister, their thinking was that they wanted to recruit 10,000 extra troops to the military. And this is essential because if they're going to go after Hezbollah, they need to not only take, but they need to hold. What I heard is that tomorrow, when the Lebanese armed forces present their plan to the cabinet, like I said, they will say it'll take us 15 months, whereas the cabinet wants 4 months. The reason they're saying 15 months is that the military are saying we don't have enough people to do that. If we want to go after all the arms depots, we need fighters and soldiers, and we don't have them. So I think at this point we should probably trust the Lebanese armed forces a bit more. I'm not saying give them supersonic jets or anything, but just say, fuel is fine, water is fine, bullets are okay, more salaries to recruit more soldiers is also fine. I think if we give them the support, given what they've done so far, which has been commendable by our standards, by the Israeli standards, everyone thinks that they're doing a good job. I think we should trust them a bit more and offer them more resources at this point.
Well, that makes sense. And it also raises another kind of question. You mentioned the money's coming from Qatar right now, and you weren't happy with it, and I'm not happy with it either. And Qatar should just go home. Is political influence coming with that money? Has Qatar exercised political influence? And this will raise the question of Turkey as well, because Qatar and Turkey have become increasingly close over a variety of things, mostly having to do with Syria. And we're not talking about Syria today because I said we wouldn't. But in Lebanon, if they are funding the Lebanese armed forces, does it bring them political clout? And does Turkey have political clout? And the other question that goes with this is I understand the Lebanese government removed a number of soldiers from the Lebanese armed forces because they were, in fact, Hezbollah. Is there Hezbollah presence in the Lebanese armed forces to the extent that we should worry about it if we give them money, food, and fuel? Or is it a minor operational problem?
So let me answer first the second part. And of course, there are Shia in the military. The Shia are one third of the Lebanese population. Now, this doesn't mean that these Shia are loyal to Hezbollah. You probably might have heard a few weeks ago, the military went into one of the caves of Hezbollah where Hezbollah stored its arms, and there was an explosion, and six of the troops died. Of course, Hezbollah didn't say any word about this. The military issued a statement saying there might have been foul play, and the military never said that there was no foul play. So at this point, everyone is thinking whatever they want to think, but there might have probably been foul play from Hezbollah, booby trapping whatever the army was trying to get out. But the reason I'm bringing this up is to say that of the six who were killed, at least three of them were Shia. And Shia from Baalbek. And I saw pictures of the funerals and the families. And the families were angry. I mean, this is the national army, this is the military. They pledge allegiance to the state and the army. And they were angry at Hezbollah. So the fact that we have a Shia person as a soldier or on the staff of or on in the army doesn't automatically mean that they'll be loyal to Hezbollah. Now, out of the 10, 15,000 Shia that we have in the military, how many of them are or have sympathies at least, not necessarily loyal, have sympathies with Hezbollah? I can't really tell, but I wouldn't say that this gets to a point where we should reconsider any aid or assistance that we're going to give to the Lebanese armed forces. I think the senior, the higher up we go in the ranks of the military, the more loyal these people become to the army. Like every army, the army usually has its own ideology, and it trains its people not only in term on arms, but also on how to be a patriot, how to be loyal to the military and to the country and to the constitution. So the Lebanese military has all of these things, and it is well respected. I don't say that I don't think that Hezbollah will ever go on a clash head to head with the Lebanese army. For one thing, it's because the army is popular among the Lebanese. It enjoys the support of the Lebanese. So I'm okay with the army now. I think if we give them more assistance at this point, I think this is something we should do. Now, going back to Qatar
Okay.
and to Turkey.
Before we go back to Qatar, you've opened another door here, so it's your fault. Okay, I fully agree with you that all Lebanese Shiites are not Hezbollah. I mean, that's a ridiculous thought. However, I have heard concerns among Lebanese Shiites that without Hezbollah, without some armed presence that kind of belongs to them, they as an ethnic and religious group inside of Lebanon will be at risk of retaliation from other groups, from Christians, from whatever's. You saw it in Syria. The Alawites were attacked by al-Tolani's forces, and I think that was reasonably so in the sense that they oppressed the other people. So how realistic is it to think that Lebanese Shiites, non-Hezbollah Lebanese Shiites, are afraid that they will need assistance in staying safe?
Okay, well, that's a great question, and here are a few points in response. Number one, the Shia are not a minority in Lebanon. They're the second biggest sect, and not by a big difference. So you have the biggest sect being the Sunnis, right after them the Shia, and then the Christians. Each one of these groups makes one third of the Lebanese population. So we're talking about one third of the Lebanese population. It's really hard to oppress them, even if when they're not armed. In the case of the Alawites are barely 20% of the Syrian population. And in the case of the Druze, they're barely 5% of the Syrian population. So in the case of Syria, we're talking about actual minorities in terms of numbers. So that's a disadvantage that the Shia don't have in Lebanon. You know, they have the advantage of having the numbers. Number two, retaliation and revenge usually happens after civil wars when two or more groups engage in going after one another in terms of massacres. And this happened during the Lebanese Civil War, especially in the mountain between the Maronite Christians and the Druze. And after that, you know, when the Civil War ended, there were reconciliation and money was paid to both sides, and you know, things were sorted out. In the case of Hezbollah, there's no clashes. There has been no clashes between the Shia and any one of the sects of Lebanon. There's no blood that was spilled between the Shia, say, and the Sunnis, or the Shia and the Christians, or the Shia and the Druze. Now, of course, everyone knows that Hezbollah killed Hariri, but everyone understands that this is Hezbollah and this is a political move. This was not the Shia going out en masse. And just whatever they encounter, say Sunnis kill them, like what happened with the Druze on July 16. You know, the Sunnis of Julani went to the south. Whatever they found a Druze, for the mere fact of being a Druze, they killed him. This didn't happen in Lebanon. So I think when the Shia use this, they use it as an excuse. Hey, listen, if we give up our arms, Israel will come in, you know, to take revenge. Julani will come in because, you know, the Hezbollah fought in Syria, so they're thinking, okay, maybe now the Syrians will want to take revenge on us. I don't think any of these threats are real. And I think with a strong Lebanese military and a capable Lebanese state, I think the state would be more than capable of defending, you know, any attack, warding off any attack that might go the Shia way. So I don't think this is a point that we should worry about as policymakers.
I think that's an important distinction that you've made there. Thank you. So now we can go to Qatar and its influence on Turkey's influence.
Sure. So this is what we have. Of course, you know, everyone knows what Qatar does. I mean, they support Muslim Brotherhood and Islamism here, there, in California, in Beirut, everywhere, you know. So that's Qatar, and that's something much bigger than this session. Now, what we have happening, and this is also something big that's unfolding, but I invite everyone to keep an eye out for it. The weakening of the Islamist Iran regime has given the space and opportunity for the Islamist Turkish regime to try to take over and succeeded as being the empire that's controlling the region. And what we see now, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Hakan Fidan, his foreign minister, who until very recently was his intelligence chief, these two guys are expanding. If you thought that Qasem Soleimani was running the Middle East 10 years ago, remember the name Fidan. You know, he'll be our new Qasem Soleimani. And these guys are going fast and deep inside of Syria to dominate Syria, to make sure that whoever is ruling Syria is a puppet of Turkey. And they're doing a similar thing in Lebanon. Now, Lebanon is still way too early. What they're doing in Syria is the result of 10 years of nurturing and sponsoring and protecting militias that were governing the border provinces between Syria and Turkey. Now, we don't have an exact similar example that's happened in Lebanon, but we have something that should be a warning sign for all of us. A few weeks back, a few months back, the Lebanese held their municipal and mayoral election. And if you look up the areas that are predominantly Sunni, mainly the north, Tripoli and the north, and the capital Beirut, you will find out that the majority of the votes went to pro-Turkey, pro-Qatar candidates. So the moderates, the ones who used to support Rafiq Hariri, the ones who used to support Saudi Arabia, were wiped out. Not disappeared, but wiped out, lost significantly. And this is the fruit of the Saudi policy of pulling out from Lebanon between 2017 and 2024, I guess, 2023. The Saudis pulled out completely of Lebanon after decades of having influence and having proteges and supporting Hariri. You know, the Lebanese prime minister is usually Sunni, and this Sunni person is usually connected to Saudi Arabia as the biggest Sunni power in the region and the world. So when this stopped, this gave space to the Turks and the Qataris to move in. So as we speak now, the balance of power inside of Lebanon tilts toward Qatar and Turkey, which means it tilts toward the Muslim Brotherhood and the Islamist brand of Islam, not the moderate Islam that the UAE and the other guys and the Saudis are towing. So this is the balance that's now tilting in Lebanon. I'm afraid that it might shift drastically in the favor of Turkey and Qatar, given that Syria itself, which is, you know, much bigger than Lebanon and right on the border of Lebanon, if Islamism keep on spreading in Syria the way that it's spreading now, there's no way that it'll stay out of Lebanon. Especially that the Tripoli to the north is really connected to Syria. There are areas in Lebanon that, you know, you can that are really connected without any concern. Now Beirut is removed. If you want to get from Damascus to Beirut, you have to go over the Biqa'a Valley and the mountains. So that's a lot of Shia and Druze and Christians before you make it. But in the case of the north, the Sunni connection over there, you know, is there for everyone to see. So that's something that worries me.
So there are a lot of people playing in Lebanon. For a little country, it's a lot of people that want to play. Raising the question, the US envoy Thomas Barak has been in Lebanon, he's been in Syria, he's been in Turkey, he's been everywhere. Is he, don't want to say pro-Turkey, he's pro-US, but he has in more than one case sort of sided with Turkish interests. Could this be a longer term problem?
Yes, and there's a reason why we appoint different ambassadors to different countries, and that's because we assume that the ambassador, the mission of each one of our ambassadors is to improve our ties with the host country and to defend our interest in the country where they're serving. So now in this case, there's a clash of interest because the person who's our ambassador to Turkey, Mr. Barak, is also our envoy to Syria. And we know that Syria has ambitions in, we know that Turkey has ambitions in Syria. So that doesn't really make sense to me. We should have had someone different on Syria so that he and Mr. Barak would, you know, not be on the same page all the time. Each one of them will have to defend, you know, the country that they represent and our interests in that country. And the cherry on top is that Mr. Barak just appointed himself as the envoy to Lebanon. So now he has these three countries. And if he's the one who's hanging out with the Turkish government, because that's his job, of course, being close to the Turkish government, it doesn't make sense that he comes from Turkey and gives instructions to what the Lebanese should and should not do. And this is only diplomacy in terms of, like, you know, ABC diplomacy I'm talking about. Now, going to Mr. Barak himself, I think he's given and posted and issued statements that have been catastrophic, some of them nearing full diplomatic blunder. I'll give you an example. He negotiated an outline that was called the Barak paper. And this outline was the sequence, a phase sequence of steps that Lebanon, Hezbollah, and Israel should do for the disarmament and the demarcation of borders to take place. Now, number one, this doesn't make sense because the cessation of hostilities itself was called the mechanism. The reason we have the mechanism is because Israel said, listen, we have a resolution 1701. It tells us what everyone should do, but there's no sequence or order. So we came up with a sequence and order and we called it the mechanism. Now, Mr. Barak showed up and he said, okay, now we're having an outline to sequence the mechanism that we already have. But that's not the problem. The problem is that he negotiated the paper with the Lebanese. The Lebanese cabinet approved it on August 5 and August 7, like I said. And this paper has stipulations what Israel should do, with the exception that he never consulted with Israel before he committed the Israelis to this paper. So after the Lebanese cabinet voted on it, and then the Israeli Air Force took out Hezbollah guy, the Lebanese said, what happened? We voted on this, and you guys are, and this is said, we're sorry, no one told us about this paper. So this to me was a huge mistake on his part, that made things really worse for each one of the three parties involved. And then after that, he had to visit Jerusalem. He met with Bibi Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel. And Israel said, listen, we can't really sign on what you committed us to because it really takes out Israel policing Hezbollah very early on in the process. So what we can offer you instead is that we can issue a statement in which we say, we will reward whatever positive steps that Lebanon takes. We will reciprocate. We will help them disarm Hezbollah. We are friends. We like them, so we're not here to obstruct whatever they want to do. But this didn't solve the problem that now Hezbollah and Birri are saying all the time, listen, Israel violated this deal, So now it's stuck in the heads of the majority of the Shia of Lebanon that, listen, even when the cabinet voted on something that America had asked us to vote on, Israel didn't comply. So this is just an example of how diplomacy needs people who learn diplomacy at school. I mean, with all due respect to Mr. Barak, and I know that he's an excellent person in terms of business and business deals, but sometimes business deals and diplomatic deals are not exactly the same.
Do we not have an ambassador to Beirut? I know we
We
don't.
do have an ambassador that's outgoing now, and we have Lisa Johnson. Is her term is ending. The Senate held a hearing for Mr. Michel Issa, who should be our new ambassador in Beirut, except that knowing the Senate, there's a huge hold up for everyone, so he's not being confirmed. Other people at state are not being confirmed, so now we're stuck in a position where the ambassador that we have is an acting ambassador, so to speak, and then the one we should send is not there yet.
So that leaves a wide open path for a person like Tom Barrack to say, look, let's just keep doing these things, right? He's not the ambassador, but in the absence of an actual functional American ambassador, he can take more responsibility perhaps than he is supposed to. And that is worrisome. Which, yeah.
No, I think, look, I mean, I think we have a good team in Lebanon. I think to be fair, he's done some good deeds. And Morgan Ortegas, who started on working on Lebanon before Mr. Barak showed up, was doing great. And now she's back on the team. So I think now the team is going overall in a positive direction. Now, not, such missteps like the outline that I talked about, notwithstanding, but I think, there's room to fix these things. And if we keep on pushing the Lebanese state, supporting them, supporting the LAF, pushing them in this direction and staying focused, on what they have to do, like I said, still cautiously optimistic. But it's really advisable to let Mr. Barak focus on our relationship with Turkey. Turkey is not a small country, they're a NATO ally. There's a huge number of issues that we agree and disagree on with the Turks. So, and that's a lot to handle. So there's no reason why we should have one person just to Turkey and do Syria and then do Lebanon on top of it. and send him to talk to the Israelis. You know, that's like four countries. That's half of the Middle East probably on one trip.
That's most of the important ones. Okay, so now we've seen how the Lebanese are maneuvering, how Qatar and Turkey are maneuvering, how the United States is maneuvering. Stick France in there for a second, because the French keep wanting to be important. I mean, they clearly want to be, but Macron needs to be important someplace because he's not important at home. So, what are the French doing in Lebanon?
Look, I think the best way to understand how the French operate is to think that after President Trump pulled out of the nuclear deal with Iran in 2018, they tried their best to keep two big contracts that they had with the Iranians. In the window of 2 years, Total signed a $5 billion contract to develop the southern oil fields, Pars. In Iran. And Airbus signed a 30 billion or 25 billion deal with the Iranians. So the French had roughly 30 billion. And between 2018 and last week, they were still trying to keep these contracts going. So most of the time, what the French do is that they see contracts, even or especially if these contracts are, not anyone would touch them. Like in this case. So in the case of Lebanon, I think, to sum their behavior in one word, their behavior has been destructive. I mean, if you take the French out of Lebanon and everything connected to Lebanon, I think it'd be a net positive. They've been in touch with Hezbollah for a long time. They've been spoiling Hezbollah for a long time for no obvious reason. They probably hope that they will get that they will win the contract to rebuild the port of Beirut, which was obliterated in the 2020 blast. So at this point, I don't really see coherent French policy in the interest of Lebanon first and then of France and the allies of France, Israel, the United States, everybody else. It's just a mishmash of policy and politics that changes by the day, depending on the contract, depending on who they talk to. I mean, as someone who's been in Lebanon all my life and who's done Lebanon all my life, I think if France gets out of Lebanon, that'd be in the best interest of everyone.
Okay, so now we need to get France out, we need to get Qatar out, we need to get Turkey out, and we need to get UNIFIL out. Hussein, tell us the story of UNIFIL. You've met with them, I've met with them. Tell us about UNIFIL and tell us about this decision to terminate their mandate.
Well, the biggest irony about UNIFIL is their name, because we know that UN interim force in Lebanon, and this interim was set up in 1978, so that was 47 years ago. So I mean, for an interim force, that's a long, long interim period. And over, throughout this period of time, just try to think of one exchange of fire that UNIFIL stopped. Or managed to negotiate to stop. Or, I mean, the guys are spectators, and those who know them know that they spend their evenings hanging out, enjoying Israeli nightlife, and then they drive back to Rosh Hanikra, Naqoura crossing, and that's it. All day long and getting paid for it. Now, why I want them removed, number one, was because they took agency out of the Lebanese government. So the Lebanese government became reliant on these guys as their conduit with the Israelis. If anything wrong goes with the Israelis, the Lebanese never talk to the Israelis, even though they're just across the fence. They go to the UN and UNIFIL, and then UNIFIL has to talk to the Israelis and come back to them. So there's no reason why we should pay to have an extra layer between two neighboring countries. Number two, they gave a false sense of observing things and keeping things peaceful when we know that Hezbollah was digging tunnels right next to their headquarters. And of course, Hezbollah knew that Israel will avoid to strike in an area next to UNIFIL. So they used that. They exploited this thing. And number three, the budget, the annual budget of UNIFIL is 500 million a year. I think we, the United States, probably pay 200 of these millions. Now think, what do they do with this money? They don't use them for bullets, you know, they never shoot. They don't use them for anything that's military. If you look up, if you check out their page, the UNIFIL page, you will see that they dug a well in that village. They fixed the sidewalk of another village. So this money ends up going to support the villages of the supporters of Hezbollah. So this 500 million ends up supporting Hezbollah's economy in the south. I mean, if each one of these guys bought a sandwich, that's a whole lot of sandwiches and money that, you know, in the southern Lebanese economy. So this became a sacred cow that the French kept on feeding. Again, the French, you know, no one knows why the French do that, except that they have a big a contingent of the French troops with the UNIFIL. But there was no reason why the UNIFIL should stay. So I'm happy to see that starting with the cessation of hostilities of November 27, UNIFIL was not even mentioned, unlike in 1701, when UNIFIL was expanded from 2,000 to 15,000. UNIFIL was not mentioned. It was understood that UNIFIL is, you know, is useless and irrelevant. And I'm really happy that President Trump just killed the force. Now, you know, to be nice to the Europeans, we gave them a 16-month final round, but I'm hopeful that after the 16-month, this will be part of history and it'll be behind us.
So it seems that we would spend our money better taking it away from away from UNIFIL and giving it to the Lebanese armed forces. Why did President Trump give them 16 months? It seems to me that you have a series of conflicting things here. You have the Lebanese armed forces, which claims it needs a certain amount of time to do its job, and then UNIFIL has a different amount of time to do whatever it isn't doing. Why did he give them 16 months in your
Well, yeah, my understanding is that this has to do with politics with the Europeans. France came to the Security Council with the resolution, the renewal resolution, the annual renewal resolution. They used to renew the force every August. So the French came to UN Security Council with this resolution. And the only way for us to stop it was to veto the resolution. And this is something we don't do with allies like France and Britain. You know, we try to avoid that. So short of escalating this all the way to an open confrontation with the French, I think the best compromise was just to tell them, okay, we'll do it this time, but this is final. And, you know, I have to commend the US mission at the UN, because they insisted on the word final. Even though the French was trying to say, okay, final, but after that, you know, we discuss what happens next. And I think, you know, our mission insisted, final is final. You know, this is the last cent that you're getting from us to fund this for 16 months, and after that, everyone goes home. So I'm happy it unfolded this way. It would have been much better had we just killed it and said, okay, no renewal. August is over, you go home. But again, you know, we have allies, the Europeans are there. Too many complications.
Yeah, and I think you probably also always have to consider the administration, the US administration, dealing with our European allies on places like Ukraine and wanting them to do certain things. And so it's really a bad idea to have open confrontation over this sort of thing. I mean, this is seems to me one of those places where a little bit of US backtracking or US compromise is not.
Absolutely. And we were trying also to convince French to endorse snapback, which is really important. So they did with the Europeans. So they were giving us something, so we had to give them back on other things. Now, granted, the French are going all the way to the two-state solution, but that's a different story. But you know, there's always give and take between us and the Europeans over this.
Yeah, well, the two-state solution is something. See, that would take us way away from where we are now, and we're not gonna do that. However, there was one country. I mean, you alluded to. We really talk about, and that is Iran, which had big investments made in Lebanon and in Syria, all of which appear to be wiped out. Now, in your view, both in Syria, and we're not really going to do Syria, but in your view. Are the Iranians out? Is this too now non-Iranian spaces?
Yes, I think to a large extent, the only threat from Iran in the region at this point is the ballistic missiles. The ballistic missiles that Iran would fire on Israel or anybody else, and the ones that come from the Houthis in Yemen. But in Syria and Lebanon, at this point, I wouldn't say that the Iranians remain as a significant threat to Israel or to anybody else. Now, in Lebanon, you know, the and we talked about how the Shia would feel if they get disarmed. In Lebanon, the arms of Hezbollah have two functions. Number one is as the Iran function against Israel, but number two is the Shia against the rest of the Lebanese. So that part has a communal angle to it. But when Hezbollah is disarmed, and even if it's not disarmed at this point, if you remember 2 years ago, anytime we mentioned the word Hezbollah, we said after that the 150,000 missiles trained on Israel. Now that's not an issue anymore. So thankfully, this is out. So we understand that as a threat to Israel, Hezbollah is not what it used to be. Now, granted, Israel must keep on policing Hezbollah, otherwise it'll reconstitute. And I think the Iranians would be happy to foot the bill to see the Hezbollah regroup and rebound. And if the Lebanese army has not disarmed them, then we'll have to have the IAF doing what it's doing now, just, you know, staying in the air, making sure that they do not regroup. But that's it. You know, the investments that the Iranians invested in Syria are gone. And the reason I say they're gone is that when they gave Assad all this money, they took in return either real estate assets like vast tracts of land or state facilities, you know, the electricity production, or all of this is gone with Assad now. You know, I mean, Assad doesn't own anything in Syria, and so does Iran. And the same thing applies to Lebanon. You know, all the investment in Hezbollah, I think all the arms are now, most of the arms are now gone. So Iran doesn't threaten Israel in Lebanon and Syria at this point. And like I said, I'd be really focused on Turkey. Turkey is building its militias in Syria the exact same way that Iran used to build them. And I think it won't be long before you start hearing about Islamist militias in southern Syria threatening Israel, you know, with the 150,000 missiles like we used to say about Hezbollah.
Well, there are conversations between Syria and Israel at this moment about the future. So I don't know if you want to be optimistic, I suppose you could try that. I have some doubts about it. I'm a basic pessimist, which is why I always ask a guest to leave on an optimistic note. But we also got a question or a comment from somebody. Given that Syria and Lebanon, he's referring to, but I'm going to mention Syria too. You have a social and political makeup with Sunni and Shia Muslims, Maronite Christians, Druze, other Christians, Palestinian Arab refugees, Syrian civil war refugees, and clans who have their own centers of power. So the question that is offered to you is, how do you create a unitary state that protects its people and where they don't see the need to go shoot each other for their own regional or confessional interests? Can you make a unitary Lebanon? And this is where we get to the question of, what if they succeed and what if they don't succeed? What do you get?
Well, the question comes from someone who knows Lebanon clearly well, it seems,
Yes,
because you
it
know
does.
they know the components of the Lebanese. Look, I think if you leave the Lebanese to their own devices, they buy, they sell, they dance, they party, and that's how they, you know, that's their way. Which makes me think that in the case of Lebanon, the best government is the smallest government. I mean, libertarianism goes a long, long way in Lebanon. The only thing that we need for that to happen is just to have a decent amount of policing in terms of stability and security. And once you do that, you'll have everyone just enjoying their time. Now, I'm not saying this as what I hope or as a projection. I'm saying this out of experience. That between 1949 and 1979, 75 at least, The Lebanese were the happiest people among the Arabs. You know, I mean, in 1967, when all these Arabs were disappointed that they were crushed, and the Lebanese were singing and dancing and having fun, and all the Arab investments were going to Lebanon because Lebanon was the safest spot. And everyone called it the Paris of the Middle East or the Switzerland of the Middle East, or you name it, you know. So this epithet came to Lebanon because of these years. These years in Lebanon, when all Lebanon had to offer was stability. And when that happened, no one knew that they were Christian or Druze or Shia. Everyone was making a buck and everyone was happy. So this is exactly what people like me and other people who are focused on Lebanon are trying to take the country back. Now they're saying, listen, the Palestinians can worry about two state, five state, no state. You know, the Jordanians, the Egyptians can worry about their stuff. But just let's take back Lebanon to before 1969, to before when the Palestinian militias were allowed to operate, before when Lebanon was part of liberating Al-Aqsa or, you know, doing or fighting imperialism. Just let's take back Lebanon to these days. And listen, during these days, there was corruption. There were oligarchs. There was sectarianism. You name it. It was not an ideal country, but it was working. So, you know, let's just go back to what was working and take it from there.
So we missed one, and then I'm going to get back to this. Someone has just sent in a comment that said, didn't France create stability via economics during that period? Was that French imposed, or was that just sort of up from the bottom?
No, the French had left Lebanon in 1943. So between 1943 and 1975, the outbreak of the Civil War, these years were totally Lebanese independence. And in fact, Lebanon was closest to America at that time, until, you know, America decided, okay, we will not use Lebanon as our ally if Nasser stays out. So the US and Egypt came to the conclusion that, listen, none of us will use Lebanon. Let's keep it out of the fray. And that's what worked best for Lebanon. And that's what, you know, what we're trying to convince the Lebanese to replicate. Just stay out of the fray, you know, be at peace with everyone and stay out of the fray.
Can we get that back again? I mean, this is where you get to be an optimist if you want to, and I'll be a pessimist because I am. So you've got to get rid of, maybe Iran is gone, but they'd like to be back. We
Yes.
didn't talk about Russia at all because Russia's presence in Syria was well understood. I don't think it had much of a presence in Lebanon, but there are Russians. There are Turks, there are Americans, there are French, there are, all of these things. And if you're right, and you're right because the history of Lebanon shows that you're right, that in the period in which nobody asked the Lebanese for anything political or military, the country was stable and the country was, as they say, the Beirut of the Middle East. We can get back there. Maybe we can give them a constitution like ours, which says, essentially the government governs best that governs least. But can we? And if this fails, how much trouble is the region in?
Well, it used to be like this. The Lebanese government was really small. The Lebanese army was really small. That's why they stayed out of all these Arab-Israeli wars. Yeah, look, Lebanon is good for two things. Either the Syrian regime takes it over and controls it and makes money out of it, or Lebanon is used against Israel. There's no third way to use Lebanon. Otherwise, you have to leave it and it'll prosper on its own. You know, it's not like a strategic spot that Russia and America are fighting over. It doesn't have really energy resources. I mean, it's just a piece of land that really bothers no one if they leave it alone. So now the trick is for its population to convince everyone to leave them alone. And this doesn't happen often. You know, from time to time, what the Lebanese do is that in an attempt to overpower their domestic rivals, they connect with alien powers like the Shia did to beat everybody else, or before them, like the, you know, Sunnis did to beat the others. So if you can get these people to understand that your best bet is just to stick together and let go of the region, I think, you know, and by the way, this is, I mean, that's not only my idea. The patriarch of the Maronite Christian Church says this, you know, a bunch of other leaders, they say this all the time, take us back to neutrality. So if we can get them back to neutrality, I think they'll be in a much better position.
I'm going to count that as an optimistic view. And I'm going to take this moment to thank you for doing this with us. It's really very enlightening. I know that we don't get a lot of proper news about what's coming out of Lebanon. I mean, you really have to look for Lebanon in the newspapers if you want to understand. So this has been enormously enlightening. And I hope you're right. I would settle for neutrality. Somebody did just pop in and ask, will Lebanon join the Abraham Accords? And, that's a dream for when the Messiah comes, I think. But I think Israel would be perfectly happy to have a neutral Lebanon and a stable Lebanon and a prosperous Lebanon, and that would work. So if you're going to bet on neutrality, we're in the bet with you.
No, look, I think, Abraham Accords for Lebanon is something that I do day and night, and many others like me from Lebanon. I think if left to their own devices, the Lebanese would go for peace overnight. The Lebanese are just people who enjoy connecting with other nations. They're all over the place. They live in all over the planet. So this is not something unheard of for the Lebanese. We only need to get all the cause and all the anti-imperial forces and everyone who's trying to liberate anything anywhere, we have to get them away from Lebanon. And I think at this point, look, I mean, this summer, which is not an ideal summer, if you look up all the footage coming from Lebanon, everyone is dancing and having fun. And we haven't even made it to disarmament and the shore of safety yet. So just imagine, Hezbollah's disarmed. I think the footage will be much, much more of happiness and dancing and people enjoying their time.
I hope so. Hussein Abdul Hussein, thank you once again for a great program.
Thank you.